You're listening to the BBC. I'm Roger Hearing, and this is Europe Today, with news and comment from around Europe. Coming up in the next half hour, $1 trillion of backup for the euro. After 2 months, is it starting to work? We'll be taking a special look at where we are in the eurozone mega crisis. Also, that football match on Sunday, the Octopus predicts the result. He's plumping for Spain, but we'll get predictions from fans too. First, a summary of the latest news.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. The United States has announced that the biggest spy swap with Russia since the Cold War has been completed successfully. 10 Russian agents arrested in the US last month were flown to the Austrian capital Vienna and exchanged for 4 people who'd been in jail in Russia. The swap at Vienna Airport involved an American and a Russian plane. At least 50 people have been killed in a suicide attack in Pakistan's northwest tribal region near the border with Afghanistan. The explosion was outside local government offices. Eyewitnesses said at least 20 shops were destroyed, trapping people under the rubble. Google says China has renewed its operating license in an apparent compromise following a dispute over hacking and censorship. Google had angered the Chinese leadership earlier this year by threatening to pull out of the country. Coverage of news has come to a virtual halt in Italy as journalists strike over government plans to tighten the rules on wiretapping. The government says the law is needed to preserve privacy. Coffins carrying the remains of 775 victims of the Srebrenica massacre have passed through the Bosnian capital, Sarajevo. The remains, found in mass graves, will be buried at Potočari near Srebrenica on Sunday, marking the 15th anniversary of the killings. The United Nations Security Council has unanimously condemned the attack that caused a South Korean warship, the Chunnan, to sink earlier this year. But the statement, drafted by the United States, stops short of naming North Korea, despite an international inquiry which found the communist country was to blame. A Sri Lankan cabinet minister, who's leading a controversial protest against the United Nations, has offered to resign, saying he doesn't want to embarrass his government. Associates of the minister say President Rajapaksa has refused to accept his resignation. The American pop singer Jennifer Lopez has called off a concert in northern Cyprus after protests from Greek Cypriots. BBC News.
BBC World Service. This is Europe Today with news and comment from across Europe. Now, it's 2 months since stressed-looking European officials emerged blinking into the glare of TV lights to announce what's almost certainly the world's largest line of credit. And a lot more than that, too. The offer of loans from a pot worth up to 750 billion euros, or $1 trillion. The idea was a desperate remedy for what was a desperate time, what some feared could be the collapse of the eurozone. Now, after a collapse of confidence in the ability of countries like Greece to pay its debts, could Europe somehow recover? Well, on Europe Today, we're going to take an in-depth look now at where we are in this extraordinary crisis.
European countries have agreed to create a safety net worth about $1 trillion. $1 trillion. $1 trillion.
The agreement was announced after 11 hours of meetings in Brussels. Here I come to save
the day. Dieses Paket ist notwendig.
This package is necessary and it will guarantee and secure the future of the euro.
It's the European response, which all the markets were waiting for.
And that was the reason why we really did this package so huge and massive. The politics took a leader position in this very turmoil situation.
$1 trillion.
Massive package.
The future of the euro.
Turmoil.
The future of the euro.
Massive package.
That was then, this is now, and the aim of the huge pot of potential backup money was simple enough to stop the rot and prevent a collapse of the system. So, did it work? Well, joining me now is our economics editor, Stephanie Flanders. Stephanie, did it work?
Well, as you say, it was sort of supposed to be shock and awe. It was supposed to scare everyone in the financial markets back into their holes and so they would never again question the future of the eurozone. But of course, there's some real structural issues underlying all this, which I think we're going to be talking about more in the next few minutes. And there were some real institutional problems. We know that European governments are not very good at coming up with these kind of policy solutions, and even worse at implementing them. You know, I think the worry, even with this big policy, was how fast were they actually going to implement them? Because all the way along, there's been wonderful statements that are given often in the late hours of a meeting, and then a few days later people in the market start saying, well, what does that actually mean, and does that mean that this bond is going to have this kind of seniority and all those kind of details? And the answer is always, well, we don't know. And I'm afraid in the case of this shock and awe programme, there was a bit of that that happened over the next few days. And the first day or two, there was a bit of euphoria and relief on the part of the financial markets. But as people started to probe what lay beneath it, and certainly the kind of political commitment behind this programme, there were still some questions. And I think those questions are still there. I mean, you have this programme, as you said, it's a credit line. It's a credit line which is really tough to qualify for. And I think many of the German officials who were involved in devising it really want to devise it so that no country will ever want to take them up on the offer, because you have to promise very, very tough budget policies and promise to do very difficult things to your economy, and they're kind of hoping that no one will need it. But if you make it that hard to use, then people in the market say, well, hang on, what kind of a safety net is that if it's never going to be used?
OK, Stephanie, stay with us if you would. Well, let's just look first at how Europe and the single currency got into the mess. Europe Today's Manuela Zaragoza reports.
It all started with a lie. Greece's public finances had been a sham. That emerged in early October 2009 with the election of a new government in Athens. No one was too shocked. This, after all, was Greece. And Greece, as was well known, had 10 years previously lied about its deficit to get into the Euro club. But George Papakonstantinou, the new finance minister, was adamant that things would be different from now on. He spoke to Europe Today shortly after his party's election.
We understand that there is a disbelief, and we're working to change that image of the country. There will not be a point where the rest of the EU will need to come to the rescue of Greece.
Less than 5 months later, Greeks were rioting in the street, and Athens was asking for help, not just from its EU partners, but also the IMF. International investors were unconvinced by Athens' efforts to control its public finances. They perceived ever greater risk and demanded ever higher interest rates on Greek public debt, effectively deepening the country's crisis. Worse, Greece's problems were threatening to infect other highly indebted Eurozone countries, such as Spain, Portugal, Ireland and Italy. Suddenly, there was a new buzzword. Contagion.
Been driven down in recent weeks on fears about the risk of contagion of Greece's debt problems.
That contagion in Europe, and of course then the market technical can lead to a sharp drop.
Worries about contagion from a credit meltdown going on in Europe.
Sovereign debt contagion go next. If as many say, look, all the fears about investing in Europe.
People everywhere were starting to raise serious questions about the viability of the euro single currency project. Strikes continued in Greece as it became clear that the EU and IMF's help came at a high price. Increased taxes, job losses and public sector wage cuts. Here's part of a report at the time from the BBC's Paul Moss.
They're not exactly saying thank you. The European Union and the IMF may have agreed to throw $1.5 billion Greece's way, but at an environmental protest in Thessaloniki this weekend, few seemed very happy.
There will be less doctors in the hospital. Something dangerous for the patients. Many people will suffer or die in Greece for the next years. The other problem is we have old machines, so it's very difficult to have a good diagnosis. And in the future, the situation will be more difficult.
Everyone looked to Germany, Europe's biggest economy, for leadership. But Berlin was dragging its feet. Germans were not happy about their taxes being spent on bailing out an irresponsible Greece. In the end, Germany's agreement to stump up part of a combined EU-IMF 750 billion euro rescue fund only came after it was read the riot act by the IMF. Wolfgang Muncho is a Brussels-based financial commentator.
The managing director of the International Monetary Fund flew to Berlin and told the German chancellor that unless she acted, there is a significant probability that the eurozone would end, that there would be a default by Greece, there would be a run on Spain and Portugal and possibly Ireland and Italy, and by the end of the week, the whole thing would disintegrate. They got scared and got bullied into this.
Bullied or not, international markets were spooked by ballooning government debt levels and budget deficits, but also by the EU's slow reaction to Greece's debt problems. The IMF EU bailout fund, while not a cure, was at least a band-aid which stopped the debt crisis spreading to other countries. It signalled that with its back against the wall, the EU could act in unison to protect its currency. It was all a far cry from the euro's launch back in 1999. 11 European states had just voluntarily pooled a large chunk of their sovereignty to create an economic and monetary union. Officials toasted with champagne, blue and yellow balloons, the colours of the EU, were set loose over the skies of Brussels. Even Germans were cheering at the time.
This is a great step for the unification of all nations in Europe, and now we have a union currency. This is so brand new, and it's an important day, and the euro will come, and the euro will be successful, and it's worth.
But there were doomsayers even then, those who argued that monetary union without political union was like putting the cart before the horse. The EU tried to dodge the issue, spelling out rules on public spending and debt levels for all countries joining the single currency. But no one, not even Germany, has stuck religiously to those limits. That didn't matter so much during the fat years of comfortable economic growth. But the financial crisis and recession have exposed the euro's fault lines, and the whole of the eurozone has had to pay the price.
Manuela Zaragoza reporting. Still with us, our economics editor, Stephanie Flanders. Now, Stephanie, let me put to you perhaps a summary of the clichés that attach to all this, that essentially the thing was always a bad fit, that you couldn't bring Germany and Greece into the same currency, and that in the end the Greeks broke their economy and it's the Germans who've had to pick up the pieces. I mean, is there truth in that?
Well, there's a lot of different pieces of that. I think it is certainly the case that when this euro started, and particularly when it was such a wide group, you remember originally, certainly Germany wanted it to be a group of countries that were like it, that wouldn't get into this kind of trouble because they were structurally quite similar to Germany. But in the end, a lot of other countries, Greece, Portugal, Spain, all these other countries, the so-called Club Med countries, got in. And the Germans weren't too happy about it, but they were consoled by the fact that there was this no bailout clause. In theory, if they got into trouble with their deficits, they wouldn't be bailed out by the rest of the eurozone. I think that the problem was that, in a sense, no one in the markets believed that. They all thought that once these countries were joined in a single currency union, they would actually support each other. So they treated these countries that had the same single currency but were very different as if they were the same, and they lent to Greece and Spain and Italy at the same rates that they lent to Germany. And the problem was that, you know, Greece and Spain got themselves into a lot of trouble. They borrowed a lot of money as a country, and not just as a government, but as a country, their consumers borrowed a lot because they had nice low interest rates. They ran up huge trade deficits. They weren't paying their way in the world, if you like. And this is really this sort of some conclusion of that. So it's not quite as simple as just, oh, Greece broke the rules and now everyone's having to pay. It's sort of everyone contributed to this by sort of willfully misinterpreting what the whole single currency zone was all about.
OK, that's the past. Now let's try and look to the future. What happens next? Just before we go into that, let me play to you a little piece from what George Papandreou, George Papandreou, I think, in fact, the finance minister, had to say about what he thinks will happen next.
These measures have a counterpart, and the counterpart is the significant financial help through this mechanism that we helped create, and which is a big step forward for the European Union. Through this mechanism and through this financial help, Greece will be shielded from the international markets and will be able to put its house in order.
So, Stephanie, is he right, or, as some people say, is it going to be the end for the eurozone? It simply can't hold together.
Well, I suspect it will be. Usually, if you bet on the kind of muddle through option with the eurozone, you tend to be right, because however large the problems are, they tend to find a way to muddle through, even if it's a very imperfect way to everyone on the outside. I think the situation for Greece is slightly different. I mean, they are a straightforward case in the sense of a country that just ran into a massive budget deficit, and a lot of people look at the books of Greece and say, okay, now there's a backstop for a couple of years, but we still don't see how they come out of this without restructuring their debt. So I think, in a sense, that quotation is optimistic in that sense. But you could still have a eurozone. It could even restructure its debt and stay in the eurozone. The much bigger question about whether the euro can survive will come down to how much Germany wants to contribute. And that's not just in financial terms, which is in its own interest, because if it didn't bail out Greece, it'd have to bail out the German banks that lent a lot of money to Greece, but also in economic terms, that it needs to grow. It needs to not just depend on exporting to the rest of the Eurozone. It needs to have its own domestic growth agenda. And that's something that I think Chancellor Merkel is still resisting very strongly.
Well, let's very briefly hear from Chancellor Merkel. Just listen to this.
Europa schaut heute auf Deutschland.
Today, Europe is looking at Germany. There can and will be no decision without us, against us. Without us, against us, there can and will be no decision, which is economically sustainable and serves the legal requirements to the full extent, both in view of European and national law.
So, very briefly, Stephanie, Germany, the indispensable nation in all this, will it keep it all together?
I think when it's faced with a choice between its two targets. The last 50 years, all of German policy has been around price stability so that you don't go back to hyperinflation and European integration. And it may have to choose between those two. And I think it's going to find it a real struggle. But the answer will determine the future of the Eurozone. But, I mean, watch this space. I don't think we've decided yet.
Stephanie, thanks very much indeed. Our economics editor there, Stephanie Flanders. Now, however bad it's been for Germany, France and Greece, well, spare your tears for a country like Slovakia. They joined the Euro just last year. Ivan Miklos is 4 days into his job as Slovakia's finance minister. I caught up with him and asked him if he thought the Eurozone was sustainable.
If some conditions will be fulfilled, then yes. But the question is if it will be. The will and courage to do what is necessary to do. And the important is, of course, fiscal stability, strict fiscal rules, enforcement of these rules, and reforms to providing necessary structural reforms to have sustainable and sound economic development and economic growth.
Do you think a financial system, a single currency system, can really encompass a country like Germany, Greece, and indeed a country like Slovakia?
It can work, but only if there will be strong fiscal responsibility. And that's the question, what will be the necessary measures and or mechanism for sustaining this? Because the problem of the Greek problems was not euro, but was irresponsible policy.
So are you saying then perhaps what you need is more political control? A lot of people say a stronger political union would be what the whole system needs.
No, I'm not saying about more responsibility or competency of the Brussels. I think it is necessary to have more strict national rules, enforcement of these rules. I mean, not only laws, but also institutions which are enforcing this.
The problem with what you're saying, sir, is if you're trying to enforce fiscal discipline, I mean, take Greece, they lied. They told an untruth about the situation. Unless you have greater political control, you can't make sure you're getting the truth, can you?
That's the reason why I'm saying about new national rules, including independent institutions which will be searching this, which will be controlling this, as for instance, fiscal council or something similar, which will be independent to the political power, to the government.
Now, sir, I know you're only shortly in this job, and, of course, your country has only recently entered the euro. If we're talking in 5 years' time, do you think your country will still be a member of the eurozone? Do you think there will be a eurozone to be a member of?
I hope so. as you said, I'm just first day in the office, which means it is... 4 years period of this election term in front of us, and I hope that we will do what is necessary to do for improving situation in Slovakia, because we have also the problem with very high fiscal deficit, and we need to have a consolidation plan and program.
And that was the Slovak finance minister Ivan Miklos ending that special Europe Today look at where we are in the Eurozone crisis. You're listening to Europe Today from the BBC World Service. Now, I've got some money. Where are you going to put it for Sunday's World Cup final? Spain. Why? Because Paul, the psychic octopus, has decreed that the Spaniards will beat the Dutch. Well, I mean, Thomas usually follows business news on this programme. Today he's been following some rather different creatures. Been a bit distracted?
Who wouldn't be by an invertebrate with mystical powers? You'd be pleased to know we'll be talking a little bit more seriously about the World Cup. You know, Roger, it's the predicted to be the biggest gambling event in history, this competition. Billions of euros. But first, let's go back to Paul the Psychic Octopus. Now, he has correctly predicted the winner of every German game so far. They're out, of course, now. This is what happened. There he is, minding his own business in his tank in Oberhausen in Germany. They put two glass boxes into his tank. Each of those boxes has the flag of the two teams up to play next, and whichever one he climbs into wins the next game. The world has been gripped. This is what happened this morning.
Und Sieger im Finale der
And the winner of the World Cup Championship Final is...
Spanien.
Spain. This is an exception because previously he's only predicted German results. And it's not so improbable that he might be right, because he's always been right so far.
You shouldn't always, what they say, follow previous practice is no guide. Anyway, are Europe's betting agents happy?
Oh, my word, they are delighted. Here in Britain alone, more than €1 billion has so far been gambled on the World Cup. You can pretty much expect the same sort of spending right across the continent. Certainly in the latter stages, no great surprises. Guess what? The bookmakers, they are certainly happy once again. Let's hear from Wally Pyra. He's from Britain's Racing Post.
Well, it is the biggest betting event this planet has ever known. And purely and simply, that's because of new technology where people are able to bet on the internet via their mobile phones. There's billions and billions of euros have been bet all around the world.
And the fact that Holland and Spain are now in Sunday's final, how good or how bad has that been for European bookmakers?
As it's turned out, it's been particularly good for bookmakers. The group stages were wonderful for them.
Why is that?
Well, the reason being is that a lot of people, there's a lot of short price favourites in the group stages. People would bet like England to win their group. They didn't. A great result for the bookies was Italy going out of the World Cup via the group stage. And also another hot favourite, France, disappearing out of the group stage. So they were wonderful results for bookmakers because the punters would put those in what I call accumulators, where, you know, they would pick four teams and they would all have to win. Short price favourites, of course, two of them have gone.
How has technology changed the way we put bets, not just on the football, but all sporting events and indeed anything else you want to think of?
Well, it is. The technology has changed completely. Where once upon a time, you know, a customer wanting to place a bet would just do it via the telephone, or from the 60s, go into the local betting shop and place his betting slip over. Now the technology has opened up that within seconds, you can bet on your personal laptop, your internet at the office, your mobile phone, you can put it on. You can place a bet anywhere. If you were even in watching a movie in a cinema.
Wally Pyra there, speaking to our very own Owen Thomas. But of course, the only question that really matters, who's going to win? Joining us now from the head coach of Dutch Football Academy in London is Johan Oosterling, a big fan of the Dutch national team, and Rafa Otero, an architecture student with us from Madrid. So, all right, gentlemen, well, first of all, to Johan, just tell me, who do you think will win?
Obviously, I would believe that Holland will win.
Oh, come on, be unpredictable.
Well, this is the thing, you know, you've got to be a little bit biased being Dutch, but I think based on the previous results, I think we can see as well Holland's been unbeaten for many, many matches, and they obviously have played very, very calculated football, and I think because Spain will probably try to do a similar thing, I think Holland will have the edge with their attacking stars.
OK, Rafa, surprise me, tell me you don't think that Spain's going to win.
Oh, no, I have to completely disagree. We have got the feeling that Spain's going to take the World Cup, of course.
Yeah, okay.
I think we have.
Why?
Well, we've reached so far. It's the first time we've done, and we think we deserve it. Dutch people have played two finals, have lost them very long ago, but I think they know how to do it. So we might surprise and take the win.
Yeah, okay. Well, you've got the support of an octopus. Does that give you confidence?
Of course, all the confidence that we can have from a German octopus, but yes.
Well, I have to tell you that Manny the parakeet in Singapore, who's a rival in terms of animal prediction, has his beak on Holland. So, Johan, are you into parakeets?
Definitely. Of course, after the predictions of the octopus, I mean, they were all correct for the German team. So that's obviously got to be in our favour.
Yeah, now, but listen to this, Johan. Johan Cruyff, he has said he would take great pleasure, I mean, one of your Dutch football legends, in a Spanish victory, because he says they play fantastically well, and it's actually based on his total football philosophy, which he made famous, of course, in the 70s. Is he being a bit treasonous?
No, he's a great business mind as well, and he's got lots of businesses in Spain, so he's got great business interests there. He needs Spain to back his business as well, because in Holland, he's not selling anything at all. But to be really fair, I think what Cruyff probably also tried to do is maybe kind of like get things going a little bit, stir things up a little bit, and possibly even double bluff.
We'll see. Rafa, there's another interesting line which has come out, which is apparently the Spanish players, if they win, are going to get €600,000 each. Now, I mean, that's kind of an incentive, but in these times of austerity, is that really a good thing to do?
Well, I think they deserve it. You know, many times you speak about their high salaries and whatever they're winning, and I don't think much of that money is coming from my taxes. But you know, the FIFA wants to pay them with that amount of money, then go on. I think, I don't know, if Holland wins, how much are they going to take? Mostly the same, no?
Well,
so things are worse in Spain, but I think they deserve it.
Are the Dutch going to get a lot of money out of this, do you think, the Dutch players, if they win?
I believe it's something half the money. But, you know, the thing is, I think the fact will probably be that we actually want to win it. We don't want to have anything to do with the money. We just really want to win it. I tell you this, if you charge them all a ten of subs, they will still want to play.
Now, did either of you really think we'd be at this stage all the weeks back when we were getting into this? I mean, did you really think that both your teams would be in there? I mean, Rafa, did you think it was going to be Spain's yet?
No, completely no. We had the first game, we lost it, we were playing awful, and we really thought we were going home at the first times. But at the end, winning all those rivals and coming up, the past weeks, like a week and a half ago, we've really had the feeling that we could make it. And, you know, TV, whatever, we won the Euro Cup, so we've got that backup for us. And at the first, no, but now we really think we can win with.
Johan, did you expect this?
To be really honest, when I saw the draw a couple of months ago and I realised that we would meet Brazil on the way up as a possibility.
That was a hard one, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was kind of like thinking like, well, you know what, it's probably quite likely to end there. So after we beat Brazil, I think for myself, yeah, I had great confidence. But I must admit, all the reports I keep reading on my iPhone from Holland, you know, the players do really believe in this, and they've been saying it from the very beginning that now the players are playing at top international clubs, usually mostly European clubs, and they're all playing in the first 11 and are important players. And that level of maturity, I think, has really shine through now this time.
Rafa, what is the secret of Spain's play? I mean, what is it that makes them great?
Well, it's a difficult question. I think the way they're playing, the way they're touching the ball, and those passes they try to finish through the middle of their defense, and I really don't know, but the kind of playing, as he has said, you know, they're all top players. They play mostly in Spain, but in other places. But they know how to work together, and the coach has done a good job choosing who would like to play or who would go better on one side or another, making some changes, trying some things. And I think that has given all good support, and they're doing well.
OK, Rafa, I'm going to push you to. I mean, we talked about betting earlier. Are you putting money on your team?
Wasn't expecting, but just heard it was the biggest money event, sport-moving event money, and maybe I'll try to.
Okay.
I'll go and put my bet just this afternoon, I think.
All right, Johan, anything you want to say to Rafa about the game?
Good luck, you need it.
Rafa, what are you going to say?
Same for you.
All right,
same
gentlemen.
Same for you will need it.
We'll see if the harmony is still there after Sunday. Thanks very much indeed to both of you. Now, just before we go, we've been getting a couple of comments on that story we brought you earlier, the African Cultural Evening being held in a zoo near Berlin, being arranged by a German group trying to support the San people in Namibia. Now, Carlos Martinez, emailing from his iPhone, says, I listened to this report in my truck as I drove through the capital of Texas. Texas has plenty of problems with racism, but he says, I can't imagine anyone being foolish enough to put an exhibit of Africans in a zoo. Then to hear they're using stand-ins from Congo. They can't understand why that's offensive. They don't have the sensitivity to be educating, he says. That's it from Europe Today. Thanks for listening.
If you're new to the BBC World Service and are trying to work out what's on when, we've got a neat little way to help you. Go to bbcworldservice.com and click How and When to listen.
the BBC in Naples.
Tel Aviv.
Perth.
Accra.
Wherever you are, you're with the BBC.